Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and we have a familiar guest with us. I'm talking about Major General retired Rick Evans, who is, you know, he's been on NucleCast a few times. He is a fount of historical knowledge on all things related to STRATCOM. You know, he spent a lot of his career there and had some really interesting jobs. And one of the things that many people are struck by when they go to the new STRATCOM building is, you know, how it's designed, and, you know, that sort of inner courtyard areas is just beautiful if you've never been there. And so, you know, Rick Evans was actually a guy who played a major role in making sure that building got built. And for those of you that know, you know, Building 500 and worked in the old STRATCOM building, you know that the new one's a major upgrade, and it's really a unique and interesting space. And so we thought we'd have Rick on to talk about, you know, STRATCOM, its headquarters. You know, you've got the GOC in there. You've got all kinds of really neat stuff. And who better than the guy that played a major role in making sure the new building got built than to talk about the sort of the history of the old building, the new building, some of the kind of things that you as listeners are like, huh, I didn't know that. That's kind of interesting. And so with that, welcome to NucleCast.
Hey, thanks, Adam. Always great to be with you. This is a fun topic, and I've got a lot of history as an Omaha native growing up there and visiting SAC headquarters when I was younger, which we can talk about later, but it's got a great history in Omaha. The base does, and SAC and STRATCOM are obviously the cornerstone of that. So I look forward to talking about it with you today.
So, you know, give us sort of take us back in time and walk us through the old headquarters and, you know, this desire or this need for a new building. And then what did it take to get that building? And, you know, there's some things that I heard, you know, about, you know, that we had to essentially to get the new building, we spent our, you know, decades worth of Milcon money for it. And so, you know, tell me what's true, what's not true. And so just give us a history and then walk us through sort of some of the neat things about the new building.
Sure. Well, and this is a fun topic because it does have so much history, and clearly this audience knows well the prominence of the Strategic Air Command in our nuclear forces throughout, really going back to the 40s. And so it sort of goes back to the history of SAC and when the decision was made to headquarters the Strategic Air Command at Offutt Air Force Base. And ultimately, they came into a provisional facility, which I believe today is a U.S. courthouse on the base. But in reality, it led to building 500, which we've talked a little bit about. And that dates back to the mid-50s. It's about 650,000 square feet. It was probably the most technologically advanced place anywhere at the time. And it was built for the headquarters of our nuclear forces, so Strategic Air Command. I grew up in Omaha. When I was growing up, most people around me referred to the base as SAC, instead of Offutt Air Force Base. So SAC was always the prominent entity on that base. And really, that building 500 was the nerve center of SAC. And so the audience, probably many of you have read, seen pictures, you know, the underground command center, there's videos on it. You can go back to the 60s and see tours of that facility. You know, really just a neat location. Now, I would say I have a little history there. I actually with my family, and I don't remember exactly what year, but I will just say mid-1970s when I was a teenager, was able to tour the SAC underground headquarters and actually sit in SYNC-SAC's chair. And so I always used to tell, you know, some stories when I eventually made it back there as a 1 or 2-star general and started doing a lot of exercises and events from what would be the commander of STRATCOM's chair at that point. cool end in my career, kind of where I actually started my exposure to the military back in the 1970s. But that's just a little gee whiz story. And you know, really that history is pretty cool for me. Now, when you think about that building, though, what the audience may not know is that there's actually multiple buildings. Building 500 is the one that's above ground. Everybody sees that. That's pretty prominent. Today is the headquarters of the United States Air Force 55th Wing, one of the largest wings in Air Combat Command. But there's also Building 501, which is the underground command center. So it's a separate building, initially constructed back in the 50s and then updated in the 80s. And so that's your SAC command post, if you will. And that was built to not necessarily survive a direct nuclear hit, but certainly multiple stories underground. Still exists today, but I don't believe it's operationally used. I think they give tours. So there's some, every once in a while, people get a good chance to go down there. But really, it had the generators, all of the things to operate during a trans and post-attack, short of a direct nuclear hit. And then, as we've talked about in previous podcasts, the system is much more resilient than one facility. So clearly we have mobile command and control and other capabilities to back up the loss of that command center. But that was the hub of the Strategic Air Command, really from the late 1950s until SAC was disestablished and U.S. Strategic Command stood up in 1992. Then it took over the role as the Strategic Command Global Operations Center. There's also another building, Building 515, which is the Joint Intel Center. You've probably been exposed to that in the past, but that was really the large Intel complex that was tied to SAC and then STRATCOM, doing a lot of really important work tied to nuclear targeting and planning. And so that's a separate facility that that existed kind of on the, I would call it the northwest corner of the hill where Building 500. But that's sort of the big complex on the hill, if you will, that has all the history. The other thing that's important, and I grew up in this environment, but the fact that SAC located at Offutt and in Omaha really set Omaha up to be a prominent hub in the telecommunications and command and control world beyond just the military missions. And so you will find lots of books out there and articles about the infrastructure that was built to support SAC headquarters. Robust underground coax cable, continental wide, all connected in, microwave, radio, all the things you would require to be a military hub. But then that ultimately led to unique infrastructure coming into the area. And at one time, I've seen articles that said Omaha and Washington, D.C. were the only two locations in the United States that had backup telephone switching equipment, for example. So pretty robust capabilities. And ultimately, that led to the Omaha area being one of the leaders in establishing fiber networks. And that connectivity, most people in Omaha had some family members working at one of the 800 call centers, because Omaha was known as the 800 call center of the world, because it had such robust telecommunications infrastructure that it had the capacity for all of these hotel reservation centers and other marketing companies to come into the Omaha area. And they employed thousands and thousands of people because of that infrastructure. So the community benefited from the connectivity that SAC brought to the base and led to that prominence in the telecommunication world. And even today, that still continues. Companies like Fiserv, First National Bank, those are some of the largest credit card processors in the world, and they were all started in Omaha to take advantage of that infrastructure and still take advantage in our large employers in the area today. So that sort of takes you back, I'm going to say, the 50s to the 90s. The audience is very well aware of SAC's prominence as a military command and actually as a specified command, which is a little bit unique. And when we won the Cold War, the decision was made that, hey, we don't necessarily need SAC, but we would transition to a combatant command called U.S. Strategic Command, would take on the nuclear missions, and they would do it from the same location. So the building was already set up pretty much to take that on. But from the community perspective, the size of the workforce at SAC headquarters versus the new U.S. Strategic Command was a substantial shrinkage. And that's just part of the Cold War dividend and resulted actually some empty space in Building 500. So that was one of the things that affected the community and resulted in lots of folks leaving. SAC had a lot of general officers. And the audience, you may be interested to know that SAC, as a specified command when it was around, actually had a joint element to it, which we would know as the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, which today is a J5N function at USSTRATCOM. And there's another entity called the Joint, I believe it was a Joint Strategic Communications Staff. Those are joint staff entities that were based here, and SYNC-SAC was dual-hatted with some of these joint roles. But SAC had some joint capabilities. We always had a Navy three-star admiral here at the JSTPS living on the base to talk about the nuclear portion of targeting and how that played into the role here. But when we transitioned to a combatant command, it went truly joint, just like today's combatant command. And it exists today as USSTRATCOM, but in the building, they will usually tell you in a briefing that there was a reorganization that happened about 2002, I believe. And so this is actually USSTRATCOM version 2, when they started receiving all the extra missions assigned, the space, cyber, CWMD, ISR, some of those things that the audience is probably pretty familiar with. So all of that was going on. So STRATCOM moves into the building, really, or maybe SAC moves out and STRATCOM, what's left, stays in the building. Disestablished in 92, Building 500 becomes the U.S. STRATCOM headquarters. And as we saw the missions of U.S. STRATCOM change, really late 1990s into the early 2000s, when seemingly, as General Hyten used to explain, it seemed like every unified command plan mission that couldn't find a home, obviously, in some other combatant command, either geographic or functional, it went to STRATCOM. And so the missions started, emerging, and that led to some changes to what their requirements were. The other thing that really drove some discussions on the need for a new facility, in addition to just the age itself and the expense of maintaining such a a complex large facility, was some negative things that occurred. And one of those that occurred in the 2009-10 timeframe was a major water line break that flooded a whole area of that building, which led to power outages, which led to a lot of workarounds and expensive repairs. And I remember I happened to be the wing commander of the KC-135 wing in Lincoln at the time, getting calls like at the last minute, do you have generators? What can you bring up to help out? And obviously we're great partners. We were great partners at the 155th Air Refueling Wing with the 55th Wing and Building 500 and even today's Building 1000. Those are Air Force facilities. So STRATCOM is a tenant on the base, but bringing in capabilities so that they could keep the mission going, and proudly and importantly to us, STRATCOM was able to keep its mission going despite some infrastructure challenges. They have some redundancies built in, but that highlighted the age of Building 500 and some of the limitations, and really started a discussion about we need to replace this. And that was really led by General Kevin Chilton, the STRATCOM commander at the time, and he was there from 7 to 11, and so he started taking a much more aggressive stance and really focused in on the age of the facility and the risk with that infrastructure, the failures that they had experienced, and the impact on the mission, and the potential challenges that could be much worse down the road, and he really used that as his launching platform to advocate for something new. Initially that was termed a headquarters. And it was typically known as the headquarters USSTRATCOM or headquarters SAC, for all those times. But, one of the interesting things that we were seeing across DOD at that time was a focus on non-warfighting so-called headquarters.
Right.
what we call a major headquarters activities or something when BRAC 2005 looked at them. But, you know, one of the things they realized right away is if we just come in and tell somebody we're going to build a huge headquarters, that's probably going to have a lot harder time getting across. But really, the important realization is that this isn't just a headquarters for people to work out of and do staff work. This is envisioned, and it is an operational weapon system and a unique command and control platform within all of the Department of Defense, and really the broader national level command and control that that we require to maintain our sovereignty and ensure national security and deter and assure the missions that are out there today. So you saw a rebranding of this from a headquarters to a command and control facility. So hence today you will see most of the discussion refers to the new facility as the C2F or command and control facility. And design on that started up in 2010. They got some money from the Air Force. And then this really took off in the 2011 federal budget cycle. Obviously, General Chilton was the principal advocate from the military side, convinced the military leadership at the time that, hey, this is the right thing to do. We need to do this. We got these missions. And remember, not only does STRATCOM have the nuclear mission, but they had the space mission, the cyber mission. They had all of these very important, highly prominent, and really new age missions that were coming out. And so there was a very clear evidence that it was time to take a look at what the long-term requirements would be.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Let me ask you a question about that. So was Building 500, were there struggles with that facility to have all of the, technological capabilities that you needed to conduct all those missions? Was it kind of hard to fit everything in that building and sort of do the mission over there? And therefore that's was part of what necessitated C2F?
Yeah, so I think the building is very well connected, but clearly, at that time we were moving into fiber connectivity and upgrading networks, and the cyber mission was really always done by a sub-unified command, which was U.S. Cyber Command, which reported directly to STRATCOM. So the operational cyber mission really wasn't being done out of that building, right. Nor really was the space mission. If you think about it, when they absorbed the space mission, when the first U.S. Space Command went away, a lot of that infrastructure and those mission focused areas stayed out in Colorado Springs. And so much of what they were taking on for some of these larger missions was really the staff and the advocacy roles, less the operational side. So the building, at least my time, I arrived there as a one star in 2012. We were filling the building back up, and the building was pretty full. It had a mid 2005 timeframe. There was some BRAC actions that affected a Defense Accounting and Finance Service element that was in the building. They moved out, but over time, pretty much the building filled up, but it wasn't overflowing. And then STRATCOM, to a certain extent, had distributed commands, so task forces, and if you remember the joint functional component commands, so was able to distribute out some of the requirements. So I would say that the facility was adequate for what was required, but the infrastructure as a whole was due for an upgrade. So hopefully that's what you were looking for. Yeah, so just to continue that story, to get us to that upgrade, the other important player in this, in addition to General Chilton, was Senator Ben Nelson, who was the senator from Nebraska at the time, Democrat, former governor. He happened to be very well positioned on both the Armed Services Committee and the Appropriations Committee Defense Subcommittee. And he picked up the mantle on the legislative side and really worked with the delegation, the Nebraska delegation, and then also the STRATCOM commander to start advocating for this. And so he carried the weight on Capitol Hill. And if you recall, that was the Obama timeframe, Obama right. administration, and then also the Democrats had control of the House and Senate at that time, which gave him great power. The other interesting thing was, and this is sort of a story that I've heard different versions of, but Senator Nelson was a pivotal player in the passage of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare.
Right.
And so he was the 60th vote to break the filibuster. That ultimately led that, and you know, I've talked to him about this, and I believe that probably played a prominent role in his ability to convince the administration that they need to include this project in the president's budget, because most on this audience has who have lived in the military construction budget world know that hey, the priority is on converting units and you know truly things like that, and. And it's often requires congressional delegation interaction to get an ad to get projects on there. And this one was included in the president's budget for really the whole thing. And
who would have figured politics played a role? Who would have known that?
It's amazing how that works. But you know, the good news is it did get included in the law, and really starting with the FY12. And you can find these documents online, but if you go back, you'll find the fiscal year 2012 budget authorized the whole project. The plan was $564 million MILCON project in 3 years. That's half the project cost because the fit out of that facility to actually go do it at that time was forecasted to be about another $550 million. So really, when this came out in the 12 budget, it was about a $1.1 billion project that was included in the president's budget. And it was going to be incremental funded over 3 years. And you referenced the story that many people I've talked to in my Air Force friends complained about this because it was one of the largest, if not the largest, Air Force MILCON project for 3 and eventually 4 years running, which sort of sucked probably some of the resources out of what other people were interested in doing, which increased the visibility. But, you know, if you look at the description of this project, I mean, all the things that anybody here would understand, and anybody that's been to Offutt or, you know, any of our elaborate command and control facilities around the country. But, I mean, this is essentially a large SCIF, and it's got hemp-protected facilities. And it's got all the things to be a very prominent weapon system for decades to come. And it was designed that way and planned to be built that way.
And well, let me ask you before you move on, this is the burning question I'm sure people want to know, given what is happening with, you know, nuclear modernization today. And that is the question is, was it over budget and was it behind schedule?
Let me pause you there just for a second, and I will tell you how that story played out for me personally, which
go for it.
But so, you know, really what we saw is, remember those numbers. So roughly put $1.1 billion in your mind, about half of that MILCON, half of it fit out. And so what eventually occurred was delays and redesigns and other things that forced us to be spread out over 4 years in the budget. So from 12 to 15, Air Force MILCON budgets, and you can find those documents anywhere between 136 million and 180 million per year over 4 years. That's a pretty big chunk of the Air Force MILCON budget. And ultimately, by the time we got towards the end of that, this ended up being $617 million MILCON project. So that's part of your answer. Right. Yep. $564 million to $617 million. That's just under 10% increase.
Hey, that's a bargain now.
Well, it probably is compared to some other facilities. The other thing that happened in this was designed originally to be just a little over 1 million square feet. So think about the cost of 1 million square foot, highly connected SCIF. Now, it's not all SCIF. It's got a big atrium in the middle, but all the office spaces were pretty much designed to be to SCIF accreditation standards. Eventually, when they started getting cost estimates, and I gave you the real numbers, right? But I think the cost estimates were substantially higher, and this building ended up getting de-scoped a little bit down to 916,000 square feet, which is what we built. So yeah, the building was shrunk about 10%, but it was still over budget by 10%. And you know, what we experienced, and so my role, you know, well, let me get to the just a little bit of the background for the groundbreaking, and then we can talk about how I rolled into this. But so now think about that. Roughly 10% over budget. It's 10% smaller than what we designed. And why did that happen? We did have to do some redesigns. There were some scope changes, just like in any big MilCon project. The big one were construction challenges. And so this area is near the Missouri River and the Platte River. It's Nebraska has high amounts of groundwater, probably one of the largest reserves in the country. They effectively had to put this thing in a bathtub and line the bathtub and then build a building in the bathtub. So interestingly, today you can walk around the foundation of this underground and pretty much inspect what's going on there. And you'll see that they built what they call slurry walls and to hold back the water table underneath this. Even though it's not built on a low spot down by the river, it still had challenges. And that's just one of them. There were other things in there that were run into. And people can find these articles online. Moldy vent work that was stored in a non-environmentally protected area. There were some fire, internal fires during construction from welding. So there were a variety of things. And then, of course, what happens over time? Inflation. So you had a lot of things contributed. But ultimately, we broke ground on this building in 2012, in October of 2012. General Kaler was there. Senator Nelson was there. They made speeches and really highlighted that this is a cool project and it's going to be really important to the nation for the long term and all the things you'd expect them to say. And off we went. Now, here's an interesting, you know, maybe lesser known fact. Those that have been around SAC and STRATCOM will remember that there was a golf course on this site. And it was known as the Warrior Nine Golf Course. And stories I've heard were basically that the SAC general officers wanted to be able to go across the street, get in nine holes. They wanted alert crews to be able to go golf on the base. And so this was a nine-hole golf course that they took the site over. And I know for a fact that actually General Kaler got criticism from the USGA as to how they were going to replace the loss of these nine golf holes. Now, often has another 18-hole course, but it's not on the main base there. But they did take a golf course to build this site, and it was probably the right spot, but we lost the golf course. And then the other cool thing from the Omaha community, so the design on this was led by HDR, which is an Omaha firm. The construction was Kiewit Phelps, a partnership between two companies. Kiewit is headquartered in Omaha. Management of the project was the Army Corps of Engineers. They managed the MilCon project for the Air Force. Their headquarters is the Omaha District, based in Omaha. And then we also had the Navy, the Air National Guard, the Air Force Reserve, and, of course, the 55th Wing is the host. All involved. So, I mean, there's a lot of players in this project, and I haven't even talked about the subcontractors. And remember, and this audience knows because I deal with security, we had to build this building with people watching the trade personnel do it to make sure that people were doing what they were supposed to and not doing something we didn't expect, because it was built essentially pre-accredited for the security that you'd expect in a facility of this like, which of course also increased costs. So trying to find a plumber with a top secret SCI security clearance to watch other plumbers do their work is interesting. But it's also highly paying, according to many of the people I've heard about here. But so that's how we started, got off going, and I mentioned some of the challenges that occurred along the way, and really, you know, my time in this facility, I was involved because I was at STRATCOM in the J3, what was known as JFCC Global Strike for a little while, through 12, 13, and 14. And then I became the deputy commander's mobilization assistant with General Wilson and General Kowalski. This audience will know well, starting in 16. And then moved over to be General Hyten's mobilization assistant when he came on board in the latter part of 16. And then you know, sort of out of the blue. General Hyten called me in one day and said, hey, this project is being led by our J8, Mr. Steve Calicut, doing a great job with the Milcon project, getting all these budget things aligned, handling the perturbations along the way, but he's retiring. And quite frankly, I'm starting to look ahead at the completion of the Milcon project to figure out how we're going to move, and we're going to do it seamlessly without being able to stand down our mission. And you're an operator, and this audience already knows from our previous conversations, I've got a lot of background in nuclear command and control and the operational portions of STRATCOM's missions. I'm not an engineer, but he said, I'd like you to take on project management leads for the last however long it takes to finish this thing up. You're going to be around long enough, and you're the right person to do it. So that's, I got involved in, you know, really the latter part of 17 in the project. And then continued on until I retired in 19. The building opened up later in 19. But so to get to your question, again, about the overruns, General Hyten also explained to me, and oh, by the way, there's a DODIG investigation on the way, mandated in the FY18 federal budget by Senator McCain to come in and look at why this building was projected at that time to be 10% over budget and 50% behind schedule. So mm-hmm. that was sort of the buzzword. That's what they came in to look at. Okay, how do we get here? And of course, that world, they want to know who they can hold accountable.
Right.
And so they came in, and the audience can find this report online pretty easy. It's been, it was originally FOUO, and now it's been allowed for public release. It's got a lot of the background on it, what they found. And, you know, we don't have enough time to go into all those details, but you know, the complexity of this project, the construction delays, inflation, all of those things contributed. And there were some, quite honestly, technical challenges that we didn't expect. I mean, trying to just put a electronic security system in a space like this where it's almost all SCIF space is challenging in itself. The communications part of this, getting the external connectivity you need, and then just building a very complex building. And so all of those are highly documented there. And, you know, they also ran into skilled trade personnel shortages. If you remember that time, we were going through a building boom, and then to try to find cleared ones, that's even more challenge. So, but ultimately we got through those, and we made it through the IG investigation. They had some good findings on how to manage a large project like this, but I was the first general officer, flag officer, or SES to move into the building. So in the beginning of the summer of 2019, you know, we transitioned in 18, really from what we call phase one Milcon to phase two, which is IT fit out. And then started to actually occupy certain areas of the building in 19, and then ultimately had most of our people moved over by 2019. Coming up with a plan to move several thousand people seamlessly and without affecting your mission was very interesting. It took a large team to put that together and, you know, build the plan and then execute the plan. So I had a full program management office team that was really dedicated to this project for probably the better part of 6, 7, 8 years, really, really solid, provided the continuity and built great plans that we then just had to go execute and adapt to the changes along the way. But we did eventually start moving in the building. So I still remember participating in the daily stand-up from the building, from my office, using the connected hardware to see if we could actually get it to work. And everybody else is in building 500. I'm in building 1,000, but I might as well have been in San Diego or anyplace else, but it worked. And that's really important. And the very new concepts that were employed in that building, you know, it wasn't always clear whether or not it would all come together and work. And it did. And so we ultimately got to, I retired end of September 2019, but we actually dedicated the building about a month and a half later. So I was able to come back for that. And that was during the change of command from General Hyten to Admiral Richard, and dedicated the building and really became operational, started exercising it for all the things that the audience will be familiar with that STRATCOM does. And we had the DepSecDef out at the time, David Norquist. I remember he called it really one of the most complex construction projects in the history of DOD, but that it was going to be critical going forward, and the home of our nation's, you know, most important missions. And if you look at Admiral Richards' comments in public and General Hyten's comments in public, but you know, I pulled a quote up that I had in my notes from General or from Admiral Richard. But I mean, he called it the most, one of the most advanced weapon systems ever constructed, and that it was going to be a critical element to our national security for decades to come. It's been referred to as one of the largest and most advanced command centers in DOD. I know when Secretary Esper was there eventually, I think he called it the most high-tech facility west of the Pentagon. So, I mean, there's no question it is elite in what it's built to do. And, I mean, the IT infrastructure, how it synchronizes and integrates within the building and then with our external partners, the hub of NC3, it is that. And so that's all clear. You mentioned the Global Ops Center, so the home of the STRATCOM Global Ops Center, protected facility. Can't go into great detail about that, but think about it as a building within a bathtub, and built to be resilient and protected. And we know today's threat, a high altitude EMP, is not something we can take lightly any longer. And so it's great that we were thinking about this as we built the building. And think about the domains we operate in today, the discussion. I mean, things like GEMSO and electromagnetic spectrum superiority, we weren't talking about those, you know, 20 years ago. And right. Today we are. And so it's the home of the STRATCOM JEC, the NEC, and lots of other partners, include our foreign allies and partners that have presence in the building, and really just an elite platform. I would call it a state-of-the-art weapon system. We called it the C2F, mm-hmm. Talked about why that is, but certainly it is the technological background of our deterrence and assurance capability that STRATCOM has as a very important mission and is the hub of many missions. It's a living, breathing weapon system. People will refer to it as that. And so therefore it's built to upgrade and adapt, which the Building 500 really was outdated in being able to do that. I mean, if you looked above the ceiling tiles, you would find lots of fiber laid down there. So really just a cool weapon system, state of the art, high tech. The Omaha area is proud of it. Our nation can be proud of it. Yes, it was ultimately about a $1.3 billion project, but in today's world, it's probably worth many, many times that, and would probably cost you.
Isn't that about the cost of a quarter of one aircraft carrier? I think it's about a quarter of an aircraft carrier.
I mean, think about it. I mean, we have VA facilities and other things that are well over $1 billion. And although this delivered a little behind schedule, what the audience needs to know is we delivered a state-of-the-art weapon system and warfighting platform that will really be important to our nation for decades to come. And that, you know, really I was proud to have a small role in it. But the other beautiful thing is, because I am the executive director for STRATCOM's University Affiliated Research Center, which we've talked about, I still have an office downstairs. And I was there yesterday, and always great to get a chance to walk through and see people I know and respect, and to see the, you know, the thing still living and breathing and doing the mission that's so important to us. And really, I think it's something that if anybody gets a chance to go there for a tour, it's not really open to the public in any way, but the museum portions on the main floor are ones we take people through, and anybody that's there on military business clearly will get more access. But it is a great facility and one that is truly important to our nation. So let me stop there. And then, you know, if we want to talk about some interesting tidbits, I've got some other good funny stories, but I can take some questions, however you want to handle it. And we'll see where you want to go from here.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time for the episode. You know, we always try to keep NucleCast a drive time episode for our listeners, because we kind of figure, you know, as they're heading to work in D.C. or wherever they may be, you know, this is about the length of their drive. Hopefully they don't have a terribly long one. So we'll bring it to an end, but I want to thank you for this great, you know, it's a great history. And if you go back and listen to the other episodes where we've talked to Rick about other, you know, you mentioned some of the underground telecommunications facilities. We've talked about that in past episodes. And so go back and listen to some of those previous episodes and then listen to this one. And you'll really get a sense of tying Stratcom and the Stratcom mission, you know, tying it all together. They really kind of flow nicely. So thanks again for coming on NucleCast and giving us a sort of a great lesson on Building 500 and then now the C2F and what it does.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me again. And, you know, just to give you one last anecdote about how cool this is, many will remember Offutt was flooded in 2019, and the new building came up exactly as we expected it with power systems and everything else, and the old building kept functioning, and Stratcom was able to do its mission. So we did something good here, and we can be proud of it.
Yeah, that's the benefits of building a building in a bathtub, right? So
exactly.
Kept working. All righty. Well, thanks very much. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode. And we'll see you next time. You know, I always enjoy talking to Rick Evans. I mean, he's, you know, he's got tons of energy. He's got tons of experience. And, you know, he's just sort of a fount of knowledge about Stratcom and the Stratcom mission. You know, he spent, you know, he's a Nebraska Air National Guard guy. So he's, you know, he spent his whole career, you know, either in Lincoln or in Omaha. So he's got tons of experience and, you know, he tells great stories, and that's, you know, that's part of the greatness of it is having a good storyteller. So it's, you know, it's an interesting part. We're going to have him on for some more sort of part of our legacy series. And so look forward to those next ones.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.